of stuff. Well, I'm here to tell you to keep doing exactly what you've been doing. Keep smoking. Watch a little more TV. And eat more fast food. Did you see Arby's now has this sandwich where the entire bun is made out of cheese? You see, those other doctors are in the pocket of big fresh fruits and vegetables. Republicans know that if they concede what climate scientists, the Defense Department, the Muppets, and virtually every other country in the world know, that global warming is real, that it is man-made, and that it is the greatest current threat to global prosperity and stability, the Koch brothers will spend money against them to fund a primary challenge. This goes double for Republicans from conservative states. They know from the experience of their defeated colleagues that the Koch brothers will primary them if they stray from climate denial orthodoxy, and that the biggest threat to their reelection comes not from Democrats, but from being outflanked to the right by their own party. A Republican friend once said to me, "The easiest person to fool is yourself." I know that there are a few of my friends on the other side of the aisle who do sincerely believe that climate change is somehow a hoax, that God wouldn't let us destroy our planet or some such nonsense. But I think the rest of them know that sea level is rising for a reason other than God's benign and fundamentally incomprehensible whim. That's why during hearings in the Energy Committee, when Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz would testify about research on renewable energy, energy efficiency, and energy storage technologies, my Republican friends didn't yell at him, "Why are you wasting so much money on this renewable stuff when we're the Saudi Arabia of coal?" No, I watched my colleagues closely, and behind their eyes, I could see them thinking, "Oh, thank God somebody's doing this." One of the reasons I was so hoping that Hillary Clinton would win the election, aside from, you know, all the other things, is the clearest path to combating climate change ran through the Supreme Court. Overturning Citizens United would help break the Koch brothers' stranglehold on the Republican Party, and without that threat, some of them might be convinced to join the rest of the Senate and the rest of the world in trying to actually address climate change. But that doesn't look terribly likely right now. Having successfully blockaded President Obama's Supreme Court nominee, the extremely well-qualified and widely admired Judge Merrick Garland, Republicans succeeded in preserving the right to fill that seat for the next president, who did not turn out to be Hillary Clinton. So that's going to be a problem. Worse, the current president, real estate developer Donald Trump, has signaled that he doesn't intend to be part of any climate change solution. This is a guy who said that climate change is a hoax perpetrated by the Chinese. Why would they do that? And why am I even trying to find any speck of logic in anything he says? The thing is, it's not what Trump says that matters, it's what he does. And the first thing he did on climate change was to appoint a bunch of climate deniers to key posts. He picked a guy to run the Environmental Protection Agency, who made his bones as Oklahoma's Attorney General, by suing the Environmental Protection Agency. And to succeed nuclear physicist Ernest Moniz as Energy Secretary, he picked Rick Perry, who famously blanked on the name of the Department of Energy when he was trying to include it in a list of cabinet agencies he wanted to get rid of. Maybe the president is just a big fan of irony. But more likely, these selections mean that this is now going to be even more of an uphill battle. But no less of an important one. Climate change is an existential threat. That's why the Pentagon considers global warming to be an urgent and growing threat to our national security. And it's why the Defense Department, the institution that uses more energy than any other institution in the world, is ordering the top brass to incorporate measures to combat climate change into virtually everything they do. War planning, joint exercises with allies, training our troops. They're even developing algal jet fuel. And by the way, that's the right pronunciation, algal. It's not algal, algal, even though it's out of algae. Algal jet fuel. So, what can we do? First of all, don't get discouraged. Recent advances in renewable energy, energy efficiency, and energy storage technology have changed the trajectory of our energy use. Even if it feels like Washington isn't rising to the challenge, states and cities and universities and researchers and ordinary citizens are finding ways to make progress. This is not a hopeless cause. Also, Koch Industries isn't the only big corporation in America. Scores of Fortune 500 companies, including, oddly, ExxonMobil, whose former chief executive is now Trump's Secretary of State, have endorsed the Paris Accords. They understand that this isn't just an environmental issue, but an economic one. There are going to be millions of good-paying jobs created by these new energy technologies. I want them created here. These CEOs want them created here. And maybe we can convince President Trump that they ought to be created here. I hear the guy is big into America winning. Well, staying in the Paris Accords would help America win the fight to own the clean energy economy. But if we're going to do this, our movement is simply going to have to get stronger. Those of us who've been fighting for a solution to climate change for years are going to have to redouble our efforts to mobilize the American people behind this cause. It isn't going to be a fair fight, not with Citizens United in place, but what choice do we have? As for me, I'm going to keep making the case to my colleagues. It may seem kind of bleak to say that the future of the planet rests in large part on the consciences of Republican politicians, but it kind of does, at least right now. Thing is, like me, many of my colleagues have grandchildren, and grandchildren can be a powerful motivator, even if they don't have a super PAC. I can't speak for the Republicans I serve with, but in 50 years, I don't want my three grandkids saying to me, "Grandpa, you were a senator and you knew there was climate change. Why didn't you do anything? Also, why are you still alive? You're 116 years old. Chapter 41, No Whining on the Yacht. Those of us serving government today have many more issues to deal with than the Founding Fathers had to contend with. They didn't have to worry about antibiotic-resistant bacteria because there weren't any antibiotics. If they got a blister and it got infected, they were dead. It was a simpler and, some would argue, happier time. They didn't have to worry about cybersecurity. Then again, we don't have to worry about slavery. Then again, they didn't seem too worried about it either. Our founders didn't have to deal with GMOs or nuclear proliferation or airline deregulation or airline safety or the use of portable electronic devices on airplanes or aircraft carriers. You get the idea. They had a very easy job compared to mine. It's not just that there are more issues to keep track of than ever before. Policymaking itself has become more politicized than ever. Every single issue also now has a variety of groups advocating for one position or another. For every line and every bill, there is someone whose job it is to care about that one line in that one bill. There are people in Washington making six figures a year whose entire livelihood involves making sure that the formula for calculating depreciation on tractors doesn't change in the next five-year farm bill, or fighting to protect the Medicare reimbursement rate for a certain kind of kidney procedure, or advocating for the right of Amtrak passengers to smoke e-cigarettes on board trains. The late political scientist James Q. Wilson described it this way. Once politics was about only a few things. Today, it is about nearly everything. No issue is so obscure or frankly boring that someone can't muster a high-pressure campaign to get you to vote one way or the other on it. This means you're constantly deluged with information. From lobbyists, from public interest groups, and from the people you represent. Email has replaced postal mail as the main form of correspondence between constituents and elected officials, and it's great that a citizen now no longer has to buy a stamp to share his or her opinion. but it also means you get a lot more correspondence than ever before. Congress receives some 300 million emails a year, and you have no way of knowing whether the person who sent you that email feels really strongly about the issue or just spent 5 seconds clicking on a link they were sent by some advocacy group that generated a message automatically. So there are a lot more issues to keep track of, and there are a lot more considerations determining how you vote on these issues, and you're under constant pressure to do not just the right thing, but the politically smart thing, and also everything you say and do is covered in real time by a 24/7 press corps, and you have less time in the day to talk to your colleagues or do research or just sit and think for a friggin' second. This sounds like I'm complaining, doesn't it? Well, I'm not. As Sherrod Brown likes to remind us, no whining on the yacht. My job is a privilege, and every moment I spend in Washington, an unadulterated delight. Did that sound sarcastic? I'm sorry. I'm writing this not long after Trump's inauguration, and it's been rough. But no whining on the yacht. No whining on the yacht. No whining on the yacht. Okay, here's the bright side. Because we live in such a complex world, and because there are only 100 senators, each senator has a real opportunity to find an issue that is of particular appeal and really grab the ball and run with it. For example, Elizabeth Warren spent her entire career worrying about how average people get ripped off by big banks and other corporations. So when she came to the Senate, she immediately became a leader on those issues. John Barrasso, the Republican from Wyoming, was a doctor before he came to the Senate. So he became one of the Republicans' point men on spreading disinformation about the Affordable Care Act. Just an example, John would occasionally claim that because of Obamacare, the Mayo Clinic had stopped treating Medicare patients, which really irritated me and also the Mayo Clinic, which currently treats 500,000 Medicare patients. When I first came to the Senate, I was ready to seize the mantle of leadership on any issues related to sketch comedy or the Grateful Dead. But in my heart, I knew it was unlikely that I'd be called on to share any of that expertise. I decided just to focus on representing Minnesota the best I could, contributing to big debates on health care and education, building on Paul's legacy on issues like mental health, and figuring out as I went along where else to focus my energy and time. Ironically, my experience in show business turned out to come in pretty handy after all. In December 2009, Comcast announced its plan to buy NBC Universal, a merger that would unite the country's biggest cable TV and broadband provider with one of the world's biggest content providers. NBC Universal didn't just own NBC and Universal Studios, it owned 20-some other networks, including MSNBC, CNBC, Telemundo, USA Network, and Bravo. The proposed deal made me immediately uncomfortable, not just because of its size, but because, as you may recall, I had worked in color television, and I had seen a version of this before. In 1993, during my 13th season at Saturday Night Live, the big three networks, NBC, CBS, and ABC, pressured Congress to change the rules that had prevented the big three from owning any of the shows they aired in primetime. The purpose of the rules was to prevent the networks from monopolizing the broadcast landscape. Opponents of repealing the rules argued that if networks could put shows in which they had a financial stake in the best time slots, they would favor their own programs over those of independent producers or demand a share of ownership as a cost of getting a show on the air. The networks swore up and down in hearings that nothing of the sort would happen. It's in our interest to have the best shows on our networks. We want ratings. We're not going to pick an inferior show just because we own it. You'll never guess what happened. After the rules were repealed, not only did the networks start putting on more and more of their own shows, but they gave shows they own preferential treatment. Remember a little hit called Seinfeld about the continuing misadventures of a bunch of misfit New York Jews? Well, Seinfeld itself was not owned by NBC. It first aired in 1989. But it quickly became the number one show on TV, making the Thursday night time slot following Seinfeld the most valuable real estate on television. And the shows that wound up in that premium location on the schedule were all owned, at least in part, by NBC. Of course, there were a bunch of them because they quickly wore out their welcome with audiences. At the time, I performed at a fundraiser for the Los Angeles Free Clinic with Jon Stewart. John told the industry-savvy audience that NBC had just announced its next post-Seinfeld show, A Guy Takes a Shit on a Desk. Fast forward to 2009. Seinfeld is off the air. I'm a U.S. senator. I lost track of what happened to John. Seemed like a nice guy, though. Anyway, you'll recall that Harry Reid had assigned me to the Judiciary Committee because, basically, he had no choice. But as it turned out, being on the Judiciary Committee gave me a platform to share my concerns about the proposed deal. On average, an American household pays $2,700 a year for internet, video, and phone service. Cable companies have increased their costs to consumers over the last 20 years by more than twice the rate of inflation. And historically, mergers of giant telecommunication conglomerates had led to higher costs, worse service, and fewer choices for consumers. I also knew from experience that a new Comcast NBC Universal would have a huge incentive to promote the programming it owned at the expense of the content it didn't. Even if a network was already being carried on Comcast, it had to worry that the new combined Comcast-NBC Universal would want to favor its own competing channels. For example, the new Comcast-NBC would want as many eyeballs as possible watching its business news channel, CNBC. What would keep Comcast from putting CNBC on, say, Channel 32, next to MSNBC, the Fox News channel, and CNN, and putting its business news competitor, Bloomberg News, in the nosebleed section at, say, Channel 531. Meanwhile, what about other cable companies that needed to carry NBC's programming and the content from all the other networks that Comcast would now own? Couldn't Comcast NBC Universal charge other cable companies more for its content? And wouldn't that cost be passed on to consumers? All this raised a lot of questions, and because the Judiciary Committee had scheduled a hearing on the merger, I would have a chance to ask them. As the hearing approached, I got a visit in my office from Jeff Zucker, then the president of NBC, who brought along Comcast CEO Brian Roberts. The first thing Jeff said to me was, "This will be good for Lorne." That cracked me up. "I don't represent Lorne," I said. "I represent the people of Minnesota." Now, I know that sounds like the kind of dialogue a writer from the West Wing might write for an inferior sequel about the Senate, but that's what I said. Sorry. I was the first senator to come out against the merger, and unfortunately, I wound up having very little company. Ultimately, we lost on this one. Comcast bought NBC Universal, but in part because of my advocacy, the FCC and DOJ placed a number of conditions on the deal. The new Comcast NBC Universal would have to put content produced by competitors in the same neighborhood as Comcast's own content. For example, Bloomberg TV would have to be placed in the same cable news neighborhood as CNBC, MSNBC, CNN, and the Fox News Network. And Comcast, which of course was the nation's largest internet service provider, would have to create an affordable standalone broadband package for low-income customers and people who wanted to cut the cord on cable television and just get internet service without signing up for an expensive bundle. I cite these two conditions in particular because Comcast agreed to them and then ignored them. On the Comcast dial, Bloomberg TV was placed in a galaxy far, far away from CNBC, MSNBC, et al. As for that inexpensive, unbundled package, Comcast did create one. It just didn't tell anybody. Hard to buy a package that you don't know exists. Smash cut to one evening in early 2014. I'm at the dining room table reading my briefing materials for the next day. Franny is on her laptop in the living room. "Hey," Franny shouts, "Comcast wants to buy Time Warner Cable." "What?" I say incredulously. "I'm reading here that Comcast NBC Universal wants to buy Time Warner Cable." "That's nuts!" Comcast was the largest cable TV provider in the country and the largest broadband provider. Time Warner Cable was the second largest cable TV and third largest broadband provider. This new behemoth would not only be the dominant player in a cable market already suffering from lack of competition, do you like your cable service? But it would control 57% of the high-speed internet market too. Less competition would mean higher rates and worse service for Minnesotans who already hated paying as much as they did for the service they got. "That's crazy," I said, finding another word for nuts. I immediately called my judiciary counsel and told him to start working on a letter to the DOJ and FCC. This was insane. This was lunacy. This was nuts. We had to stop this from happening. Unfortunately, when my team got the lay of the land the next day, it looked like, once again, I would be the only senator coming out in opposition to the merger. The deal looked like a fait accompli. Part of that was because of Comcast's lobbying might. Comcast has about 100 lobbyists on Capitol Hill, a lobbyist for each senator, more or less. But this merger was so important to Comcast that it had hired virtually every other telecom lobbyist in town. Not to lobby for the deal. Comcast paid them not to lobby against the deal. They just took them off the playing field. I made my case to a number of colleagues, but didn't have much luck. Once again, for 14 months, I was the only senator to speak out publicly against the deal. But over the next year, alongside a coalition of allies like Public Knowledge, Consumers Union, and Common Cause, I continued to fight the merger. We rallied the public, and the FCC received nearly a million comments and petition signatures from people opposed to the deal. And this time, the good guys won. After meeting with regulators and being told that the jig was up, Comcast withdrew the proposed merger. One of the big reasons for the rejection? Comcast's failure to comply with conditions on the NBC Universal deal. In other words, I got conditions put on Comcast's first big problematic acquisition. They failed to comply with them. I pointed this out when they tried to make another bigger, more problematic acquisition, and that helped sink the deal. Over the years, I found myself doing a lot more work on issues of media consolidation and the rights of consumers when they interact with the most powerful companies in their lives, many of which don't offer products like cars and refrigerators, but rather services like cable TV and broadband internet. We've won some enormous victories, like protecting net neutrality, an issue in which 4 million Americans took action by submitting comments to the FCC. We're going to need to keep fighting, though, because net neutrality is in real danger now that Donald Trump is in the White House and an avowed enemy of net neutrality is running the FCC, and because media consolidation continues to represent a real threat to the free flow of information in America. These issues affect every one of us every day. And while I certainly didn't expect that being a senator would mean spending so much time working on this stuff, it's become one of the most rewarding things I do. All thanks to a career in comedy and Harry being stuck with an empty seat on judiciary. Chapter 42. I Win Awards. When I first got to the Senate, I scheduled a few appointments with my new colleagues, just to spend a little time getting to know them and getting their take on how to be a good senator. One of the first was with Chris Dodd, who had represented Connecticut in the Senate since 1981 and been a leader within the Democratic Party since the age of the real giants of the Senate, the Ted Kennedy and Mike Mansfield types, and 9-foot-tall Ed Muskie. Chris was running a little late for our meeting, so I cooled my heels in his outer office. Looking around, I noticed that the entire room was jam-packed with awards he'd received during his long and distinguished career. Plaques hung on every inch of wall space, wooden plaques, acrylic plaques, plaques of slate and granite. And the shelves, every possible surface, was covered with awards. Crystal awards, glass awards, stainless steel awards, lucite awards of all shapes and sizes, cubes, stars, eagles. I was blown away and a little depressed. Oh my God, I thought. I will never get this many awards. I'd have to be here for 30 years. How old will I be then? 80? No, older. Ah. It was a stupid emotional hole to fall in, but I fell into it nevertheless. Chris arrived, greeted me brightly, and escorted me to his office, past more and more shelves of awards. After we sat down in his office, I tried to listen to his advice, but the awards on his wall and bookshelves started to close in and mock me. "How was the meeting?" Drew asked when I returned. "Aw, man," I said, still in a funk. "He has so many awards." Drew tried to reassure me. "Don't worry about that. You'll get plenty of awards." I thought he was just trying to cheer me up, but it turns out he was right. Apparently, when you're a senator, people just throw awards at you on a regular basis. Sometimes it's a trade association or a well-meaning public interest group giving you an award just for voting their way on something. Sometimes an organization will give you one of their big awards in the hope that you'll agree to speak at their annual dinner so they can get a lot more people to come. I used to get a big sack of cash for a speech like that. Now I get a lucite plaque. In any event, I quickly began to amass quite a collection of awards in my own office, a collection that has continued to grow over the years. I will say that some of them do mean a lot to me, like the awards I've won from Consumer Watchdog for my leadership on consumer rights, or from the Humane Society after my service dog bill, or from the National Law Center on homelessness for my work on the Violence Against Women Act. Sometimes, however, an organization will go out of its way to make sure I understand that an award it's giving me means very little. I was very excited when I found out that the Minnesota Farm Bureau was presenting me with their Friend of Farm Bureau Award. The Farm Bureau is a pretty conservative organization, almost always endorsing the Republican in political campaigns as they did Norm Coleman in 2008. The Farmers Union, the progressive farm organization, had endorsed me. One out of five jobs in Minnesota is tied to agriculture. We're the number one producer of turkeys, number two in pork. The Green Giant is from Le Sueur, Minnesota. You've probably heard of General Mills. Betty Crocker is a Minnesota native. And so is the Pillsbury Doughboy, who served our nation so deliciously in World War I. So even though I wasn't on the agriculture committee, it was essential that I learn about farming, something I started during the campaign by visiting farms all around the state. I learned quickly that farmers aren't just farmers. They're mechanics, veterinarians, marketers, economists, and meteorologists. In the Senate, I had to master the very arcane world of ag policy, and even though I still had some disagreements with the Farm Bureau on things like the estate tax and clean water regulation, I fought for the interests of all our farmers. So when Kevin Papp, president of the Minnesota Farm Bureau and a farmer with a 600-acre corn and soybean operation near Mankato, came to my office to present me with my first Friend of Farm Bureau plaque, I was thrilled. "Kevin," I said, "this really means a lot to me. I really appreciate it. It's a tremendous honor." Kevin could tell that I meant it. "Oh," he said matter-of-factly, "this is only about how you voted." What he was really saying was, "Oh, don't get us wrong. We still don't like you." I remind Kevin about that conversation every chance I get, and we laugh about it. We've become pretty good friends. In October 2012, Kevin invited me out to his farm to harvest the last 5 acres of his corn crop. Kevin dubbed those last 5 acres the Franken Five. Harvesting the corn was incredibly easy because Kevin uses GPS technology to plant and harvest. The combine shoots a golden arc of grain into a truck that runs alongside, and when you reach the end, you just turn the thing around, line it up, and go. It took all of about a half hour. On the way to the grain elevator, Kevin worried aloud that my corn might be a little dry since it was harvested so late and that he'd get less for it. I had this horrible thought that the Franken Five might become synonymous with the worst 5 acres on your farm. Yeah, I pulled one over on that guy. I sold him my Franken Five. Ha ha! You know, stuff like that. Fortunately, my corn had the perfect moisture content. That's just the kind of senator I am. The Farm Bureau still doesn't support me, and a lot of its conservative members aren't big fans of mine, but I've won a few of them over in two important ways. First, I do my homework and have delivered on the issues where we agree. Second, I have a joke I tell every time I speak to an ag audience. It goes like this. You know, I grew up in St. Louis Park. I was a suburban kid. I knew nothing about agriculture growing up. In fact, when I was 8 years old, if you'd asked me where food comes from, what do you think I would have said? And the audience always shouts, the grocery store. And I say, no, I would have said a farm, because I wasn't a total idiot. Big laugh every time. Well, until recently, every farmer in Minnesota has heard it by now. Speaking of my comedic genius, in December 2015, the Writers Guild of America East announced that I would receive its prestigious Evelyn F. Burkey Award, which recognizes a person or organization whose contributions have brought honor and dignity to writers. Previous recipients of the award had included Edward Albee, Arthur Miller, Joan Didion, and now me, the distinguished author of Pornorama. I decided to point out in my acceptance speech that it didn't say the recipient of the Evelyn F. Burkey Award had always brought honor and dignity to writers, just on balance. Today, there are too many awards to fit in my office. But when I told my staff I was writing this chapter, they warned me, people might stop giving them to you. Well, first of all, I told them, no, they won't. People understand jokes. Take it from me, an Evelyn F. Burkey Award-winning writer. They rolled their eyes. Second of all, if they do stop giving me awards, that's really kind of fine. We've run out of space anyway. But they won't. To inquire about giving Senator Franken an award, please contact British Schmidt at 202-224-5671. Chapter 43. We Build a Dehumorizer. As I hope I've made abundantly clear, senators don't get a lot of opportunities to be funny in public. Remember when Jeff Blodgett, Wellstone's campaign manager, told me to try writing a 5-minute speech with no jokes in it, and I thought he was crazy? Well, it turns out that you really can't tell a joke in a speech on the Senate floor. Why? Because no one is there. The Senate chamber is usually empty except for the speaker, a few staffers, and the presiding officer, who's reading press clippings instead of listening to you. But viewers at home don't know that. C-SPAN is on a tight single of you, the speaking senator. To the viewer, it looks like you could be addressing a packed house. But if you were stupid enough to tell a joke, viewers would hear no reaction, nothing. Which means your joke died a terrible death. Still, like in any profession, humor can be a way to create connections that could blossom into friendships, or at least a little slack cutting. Plus, it can help keep everybody sane at especially stressful moments. which is true even when the people you work with don't necessarily have finely honed comedic sensibilities themselves. Here's my best example of all those things happening at once. One day in 2015, right after the Iran nuclear agreement was announced, there was a classified briefing in a secure room with about 80 senators. Republicans were eager to attack the deal and condemn the president for agreeing to it. Plus, we were talking about issues of war and peace, life and death, so it was kind of a tense meeting. And it got even more tense as we heard impressive presentations from Secretary of State John Kerry, Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz, Treasury Secretary Jack Lew, and our lead CIA expert on Iran, whom I will call simply Mr. Quimby. The Senate Majority Leader, whom I will call Mitch, was in charge of the meeting. And you could tell he was unhappy at how persuasive the administration's representatives had been. When it came time for questions, both Republicans and Democrats asked some difficult ones. But I think it's fair to say that the Republicans, all of whom ended up voting against the agreement, were particularly on edge, and some of their questions were downright hostile. The briefers, for their part, handled these tough questions extremely well, which only seemed to make the Republicans crankier. Eventually, it was my turn. I wanted to ask about something that Iran's supreme leader had said about the deal. But I was also sensing that the tension in the room was reaching a boiling point. So when Mitch called on me, I decided to at least attempt to lighten things up. Just a little bit. "Yes," I said. "I have a question about the supreme leader, who I like to call the supreme being. Now, please understand, I consider this barely a joke. But for whatever reason, probably the high degree of tension in the room, it got an enormous laugh. Even Mitch McConnell laughed out loud. Try to imagine what that looks and sounds like. You can't, can you?" Mr. Quimby explained why he thought the supreme leader, or supreme being, if you will, Mr. Quimby enjoyed the joke too, had said what he said, and we moved on. But the weird thing was the joke, again, as slight as it was, did the trick. The tension drained out of the room. Leaving the briefing later, I was still a little puzzled. Frankly, my jokes are often underappreciated in the Senate, but this one, if anything, was overappreciated. On the subway back to my office, a Republican senator, who hardly ever votes with me, asked, "Could I use that joke in my state?" "Sure," I said, "be my guest." "Why is it funny?" he asked. "Well," I said, "I guess it's because supreme leader is such a weird term to us that he might as well be calling himself supreme being." My colleague laughed again and nodded, "Got it." For the rest of the day, senators kept coming up to me in the halls and in hearings. "Great joke. Supreme being. That was hilarious." I was kind of astonished. That afternoon, I showed up on the floor for a couple of votes and found a group of colleagues happily recalling the joke. And that's when I spotted Chuck Schumer making a beeline for me, grinning from ear to ear. "I told the president your joke," he exclaimed, his eyes sparkling with delight. "Supreme one." "Huh?" "Supreme being," I said. Chuck thought for a second. "Yes, supreme being." A beat, then Chuck, still grinning, admitted, "I said supreme one." "So you told the president that the supreme leader might as well be called the supreme one?" "Yes," Chuck affirmed, still beaming. "Did he laugh?" "No." "And you told him it was my joke?" Chuck nodded, still grinning. "Yes." I love Chuck Schumer. He's one of the smartest, most strategic, most passionate Democrats in Washington, which is why he's the leader of our caucus in the Senate. I call him the Jewish LBJ. But he's also kind of a character. Running around with his archaic flip phone, barging into conversations, talking too loud, screwing up jokes, no matter what kind of relatives you have, Chuck will remind you of one of them. In fact, my daughter, Thomason, likes to say that the mere fact that he exists let alone serves in the United States Senate, is hilarious. I get asked a lot, is it hard not to be funny? I prefer this question to, why aren't you funny anymore? And the truth is, kind of, yeah, I can't help it. Even after all of this, my instinct is still to at least try and go for the joke, even when it's probably a really bad idea. For example, when I take pictures with families, I often playfully put two kids in headlocks and squeeze their heads together. It always gets a good laugh. I did it once to the two young sons of Chris Murphy, a rising Democratic star who represents Connecticut in the Senate and serves as a voice of conscience on both gun violence and foreign policy. Watching me squeeze his boys' heads together, Chris said, "That's the kind of thing that would bring joy to thousands of families until one day it ends your career." I still do it, by the way. But in general, rather than trusting my ability to sort out the funny things that would bring joy to thousands of families from the funny things that might end my career, I've come up with a strategy to avoid falling prey to the Republicans' dehumorizer. I built one of my own. It's called my staff. Every member of my staff is empowered to be the dehumorizer at any given moment. Any staffer driving me, for instance, is encouraged to respond to things I say with, "Okay, that's for inside the car." Or they oft use, "Fine, get it out of your system." Sometimes there's a group decision, usually involving my chief of staff and our communications team. The chief has final say, though sometimes I make an appeal to Franny. I don't know why, she always sides with the staff. Notes have been a running source of disagreement. During my second week in office, I wrote my first note to a constituent. Ruth Anderson of Marshall, Minnesota, was born on July 24, 1899, and was about to celebrate her 110th birthday. I sat down at my desk and wrote on my official stationery, "Dear Ruth, you have a bright future. Sincerely, Al Franken." I handed the note to Drew. "What's this?" he asked. "It's a joke," I said. "You know you can't send this, right?" "Yeah, I guess so. I don't know. I thought she'd get a kick out of it." Drew pointed out their family might not get a kick out of it. Senators write a lot of notes to constituents, to people you've had meetings with, to colleagues. Drew nicks this birthday note to John McCain. "Dear John, hope you have a great year. Of course, any year would be better than the 5 you spent in the Hanoi Hilton. Sincerely, Al." The thing about having Drew as a dehumorizer was that it freed me to write anything I wanted. If Drew rejected it, I'd just redo it. Like the birthday note I wrote for Daniel Inouye of Hawaii, who had received the Medal of Honor after losing his arm to a grenade in World War II. "Dear Danny, I hope when I'm your age, I'm just like you, healthy with 2 good arms. Oh, wait. Sincerely, Al." Now, Danny had a great sense of humor, and I believe that both he and McCain would have appreciated getting something a little different, but Drew was more concerned about my colleagues' staffs getting their noses out of joint. So I'd just write the first thing that came to mind, and if the note got through Drew, I'd assume it was fine. One day on the Senate floor, Kay Bailey Hutchinson from Texas came up to me with a big grin on her face. "I just loved your birthday note. We've hung it up in our office. It's so funny." I had no clue what I had written. My scheduler, Tara, pulled up the copy she'd made. "Dear Kay, happy birthday to my favorite senator. You're absolutely the best. The people of North Carolina are so lucky to have you representing them. Sincerely, Al." The premise of the joke, which Kay vastly overappreciated, was that I thought I was extending my birthday wishes to Tar Heel Senator Kay Hagan. Despite what I've learned about how tough a room the Senate chamber can be, I have sometimes tried to slip in the funny during speeches. Once, while working on a speech about the verification regime in the new START nuclear disarmament treaty with Russia, I came up with this. A wise man once said, "Trust but verify." That man was quoting Ronald Reagan. Drew said, no, Al, people love Ronald Reagan. Oh, come on, I said, it's a joke. Jess McIntosh, my press secretary during my first campaign and my first year in the Senate, told me she wanted to write a campaign memoir entitled, Oh, Come On, Said Franken. Chris Dahl, my driver, threatened to write a tell-all called In the Car. In April 2011, Arizona Republican John Kyle spoke on the floor of the Senate, saying that abortion services were well over 90% of what Planned Parenthood does. Actually, abortion services make up approximately 3% of what Planned Parenthood does. When Kyle got called out, his spokesman issued this remarkable defense. His remark was not intended to be a factual statement. I told Drew I wanted to go to the Senate floor and introduce a Senate resolution saying, any statement made on the floor of the Senate that is presented as factual must be intended to be factual. No, said Drew. Oh, come on, said Franken. It's funny, and it makes a point. When Drew took the chief of staff position, he told me he would have to leave after 2 years because by then both his kids would be in college and he'd have to find a real job. I asked Casey Aiden Wansberry, who had already done her share of dehumorizing as my communications director, to step into the job. As it turned out, Casey became the most unforgiving dehumorizer of them all. Casey actually does have a sense of humor, but she is also one of the most frighteningly competent people I've ever met. She kind of reminds me of the Jessica Chastain character from Zero Dark Thirty, the obsessed CIA agent leading the bin Laden hunt, except if Casey had been in that job, we would have shot off his face months earlier. Casey cracked down on this funny thing I do whenever I arrived at the Hart Building around 9 a.m. There'd be long lines of staff and visitors winding out the doors waiting to go through the metal detectors. Of course, we senators get to go straight through, so I'd worm my way through the line saying, more important than you, more important than you, more important than you. This was exactly the kind of thing that brought laughter and joy to hundreds, maybe thousands, until Yankees first baseman Mark Teixeira took offense. Teixeira, I am sure, was there to lobby for some very worthy cause for which I applaud him. But he tweeted, just walked through security at Hart Senate office building. At Al Franken, let me know, he's more important than me. And that was the end of that fun thing that had brightened the mornings of so many. Casey and I had our most protracted argument over a joke in June 2015, right after the Supreme Court issued its 5-4 ruling that marriage is a fundamental right for same-sex couples. Justice Antonin Scalia issued an unhinged dissent describing the majority ruling as a judicial putsch. I wanted our communications department to issue the following statement. Senator Al Franken of Minnesota today applauded the Supreme Court's decision and described Justice Antonin Scalia's dissent as very gay. My staff said no, but they didn't say I couldn't put it in the book someday. When I first got to the Senate, we lived in mortal fear of Capitol Hill gossip columns, which, believe it or not, exist. There are reporters at esteemed publications who just hang out in the Capitol waiting to catch a congressman failing to wash his hands after he pees or something. You're not safe anywhere. Once during the height of the Tiger Woods cheating scandal, cheating on his wife, not cheating at golf, I was on the Senate subway and joked to Chris Dahl, I'm thinking of introducing some kind of Tiger Woods stamp. He chuckled, we have fun. Later that day, Jess stepped into my office. I got a call from Heard on the Hill, she said, and they said you were talking about introducing a Tiger Woods stamp. I nodded. Well, did you say that? Yeah. Ugh, she said, her shoulders slumping. Then I just won't return the call. She turned to head back to her desk. No, I said, stopping Jess in her tracks. tell them I was citing it as an example of a bad idea, which she did. The Hurt on the Hill story came out the next day. Still funny. Senator Al Franken hasn't lost his touch. An HOH, that's Hurt on the Hill, tipster, overheard the former comedian practicing his deadpan routine to a staffer while riding the Senate subway late last week. The Minnesota Democrat mused that someone ought to introduce legislation to create a Tiger Woods postal stamp, our spy says. A Franken spokeswoman says her boss used the idea of a postal stamp honoring the scandal-plagued affair-having golfer as an, quote, example of a bad idea. We think it's a funny one. The student had become the master. Chapter 44. I Get Reelected. In my first campaign in 2008, I barely survived the year's nastiest, hardest-fought, most eventful, and exhausting Senate race, winning by the smallest margin in American history after an unprecedented 8-month recount and legal battle. In my second campaign in 2014, I ran against a friendly, very successful businessman who didn't know a lot about public policy, and I beat him by 10 points. It was a terrible year for Democrats, which everybody saw coming. For one thing, it was a midterm, and for whatever reason, we struggled to turn out voters in non-presidential election cycles. Meanwhile, the group of senators up for re-election included a lot of red and purple state Democrats who had been swept into office thanks to the Obama phenomenon and, of course, the stench from the dead, rotting corpse of the George W. Bush administration. That meant Mark Begich had to run for re-election in Alaska, as did Mark Udall in Colorado and Kay Hagan in North Carolina. They would all lose, and so would longtime Democratic incumbents Mark Pryor in Arkansas and Mary Landrieu in Louisiana. Meanwhile, open seats in Iowa, where Tom Harkin retired, and South Dakota, where Tim Johnson retired, and West Virginia, where Jay Rockefeller retired, and Montana, where Max Baucus had stepped down to become President Obama's ambassador to China, all flipped to the Republicans as well. For me, election night 2014 was pretty much the exact opposite experience from election night 2008. My race was called the moment the polls closed, and we all cheered. Then I spent the rest of the night watching all my friends give somber concession speeches. And instead of worrying that I'd screwed everything up for everyone, I kept getting asked what my secret was. How had I pulled off such a big win in such a down year? The weekend before the election, on Meet the Press, the political panel was discussing who ran the best and worst campaigns of the year. Chuck Todd had the answer. I have to give the award for best to Al Franken, because guess who we're not talking about today? Closest Senate election 6 years ago, Al Franken. Recount, all of those things. How did this guy survive? 6 years of a well-run campaign. You have to give that to him. A lot of the credit goes to Matt Burgess, who ran my re-election campaign, and the terrific staff he pulled together. In a year when a lot of Democrats were on their heels, our campaign focused on the work I'd done on things like reining in Wall Street abuse and made an aggressive argument for a more progressive economic policy, taking on hedge fund tax breaks and other elements of the rigged system. The reason we were able to run such a confident campaign, though, was that the people who worked in my Senate offices in D.C. and Minnesota had done such a great job. Led by Casey, my chief of staff, and Alana Peterson, who had been my state director ever since I took office, well, they made me look good every day, for which I have to remember to stop giving them credit. Chuck Todd was right, as he always is. I didn't win re-election because of what I did during the 2 years of the actual campaign. I won because of what I did during the five and a half years of my first term. It turns out that being a good senator, working hard, sweating the details of legislation, staying focused on the issues that matter to your state, looking for ways to find common ground with the other side, even as you stand your ground on your core principles, is good politics. That's especially true when people initially had a lot of doubts about whether you'd be a good senator or even remotely competent. "You're better than I thought you'd be," a businessman in Bemidji told me early in my term. "Thanks for having low expectations," I replied. But there is something about barely winning an election that makes you take nothing for granted. And the fact is, I had started getting nervous the day after the 2012 election was over. I was officially in cycle. In the spring of 2013, I made a quick fundraising trip to Florida. And while getting on the plane from Miami to Minneapolis, I had a conversation that made me feel much better about my prospects. "Are you one of my senators?" the young woman asked as we waited on the jetway. "You're a Minnesotan," I replied. "Yeah," she said. "Then I'm one of your senators." "Why are you here?" she asked. "Fundraising. I'm running for re-election." She nodded. "This November?" No, next November." "Oh," she said. "Is Amy running then, too?" "No, she ran last year. She won by a big margin." "Oh, well, I don't think you'll have any problem. Everyone says you work really hard." Wow, if that's what had filtered down to low-information voters, then I must be in good shape. Put that in your model, Nate Silver. Still, I didn't take my opponent lightly. Mike McFadden was a wealthy investment banker with a very telegenic family. One of his five sons, Connor, would always sit up front at our debates with a big grin plastered on his face, which I thought was intended to psych me out until I realized it was a reminder to his dad to smile, which was really endearing. It made me think of Franny sitting in the front row at my campaign rallies, frantically tugging her ear when she thought I had gone on too long and should wrap it up, which I never did. On paper, Mike was a strong candidate, a successful businessman, a Pop Warner football coach, a board member of a Jesuit high school for low-income minority kids, and a political novice who could credibly claim to be an outsider in a year when people were pretty sick of Washington insiders. Like, I guess, Mike would say, me. But one thing he had going against him was his name, McFadden. You see, before me, there was Norm Coleman, who's Jewish. Norm had succeeded Paul Wellstone, also a Jew. Paul had beaten Rudy Boschwitz, Jew. My campaign slogan? Minnesota isn't ready for a Gentile in the seat. At least that was my slogan at the Jewish Federation dinner. Mike made some rookie mistakes, such as telling a reporter that it would be fine with him if the Keystone Pipeline were made with Chinese steel. There's a reason Minnesota's Iron Range is called the Iron Range. Mike's comment didn't sit well with Rangers who had lost jobs to dumped Chinese steel. As someone who had once been a rookie myself, I felt just terrible watching him step in it like that. Actually, I enjoyed the hell out of it. Given Mike's lack of familiarity with government and the nuances of campaigning and my own work on the granular details of public policy, there was every reason for me to be supremely confident about the upcoming debates. But for some reason, debate prep seemed more difficult than it had 6 years earlier. The format of 1.5-minute answers followed by 30-second rebuttals seemed so artificial to me, and my brain, now packed with material from hundreds of nightly briefing binders, I kept giving wonky, almost listless answers that wandered all over the place. The day before my first one-on-one debate with Mike, I got a call from President Obama. I'm sure he was calling around the country, checking in on all our 2014 Senate candidates, but it was a nice gesture. "How's it going?" the president asked. "Oh, good," I said. "I'm ahead by 10 or so." "Great. But you know, Mr. President, I got a debate tomorrow, and for some reason I'm really nervous." "Uh-huh," he responded, as if he knew exactly what I was talking about. "For some reason, I'm having a hard time learning my responses." "Is it because the whole thing seems so phony to you?" he said. "Yes." "It's like you're learning lines for a play?" "Yes, but it's like I'm at war with my own answers." "Because they're not exactly what you want to say, and you want to say more?" "Yes, Mr. President, yes, exactly." I've been there. Hence Denver. The president, of course, was referring to his awful performance in the first 2012 presidential debate. Although Mike was a genuinely nice guy, it's hard to run in a rough-and-tumble political race without getting annoyed with your opponent. I didn't remind him repeating ad infinitum that I had voted with President Obama 97% of the time. But man, he really hammered that talking point. At one point in a debate, after Mike had said it for the eighth time, I interrupted. Excuse me, could you repeat that number again? Is it 97%? Let me write that down or I'll forget it, sure as shootin'. Frankly, the other thing that irked me most was one of his early web videos, in which Mike spoke directly to the camera. A lot of